The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
Hello, I'm Jack Wilson. Today is a special edition of the History of Literature podcast. We're listening to one of James Joyce's favorite pieces of music right now. That should give you a clue. That's right, it's James Joyce Day here on the podcast. And we have a very special guest, Vincent O'Neill. Vincent O'Neill is the artistic director of the Irish Classical Theatre Company in Buffalo. He's here to talk about his life in the theatre and his lifelong passion for the works of James Joyce. We talk about the theatricality of Joyce's works and about Vincent's experiences playing Joyce and bringing the works of Joyce to the stage. Here's a man who went from playing a gorilla to adapting Finnegan's Wake. Talk about an odyssey. Someone should write a novel about him. In the meantime, we can enjoy his work at the Irish Classical Theatre Company. All of you listeners who are close to Buffalo should take a look at their website. They put on some wonderful plays. They have a new season coming up. Their website is irishclassical.com. Our website, of course, is historyofliterature.com, or you can find us at facebook.com/historyofliterature. Or at jackwilson.com. That's J-A-C-K-E, Wilson.com. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Vincent O'Neill. Okay, I'm joined now by the artistic director of the Irish Classical Theatre Company, Vincent O'Neill. Welcome to the History of Literature podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start with your background, and then we can dive into your interest in James Joyce. You were born in Ireland and grew up in Dublin, is that right?
That's right. In fact, I grew up in Sandy Cove, which is on the south coast of Dublin.
Okay.
It's where the Martello Tower is.
Oh, yes.
Features in the opening chapter of Ulysses, of course.
You know, right.
The Stately Trunk. And it is now a James Joyce Museum. So that was the little beach with the 40-foot, the Martello Tower, the rocks where I grew up. So it's a kind of strange serendipity.
Right. And did you visit the James Joyce Museum? Was it already the museum when you were a child?
No, it wasn't. In fact, it was an architect, Michael Starr, who was the architect actually who designed the new Abbey Theatre, well, new when it was rebuilt in 1966 after it burnt down. And he owned the Martello Tower. He had an unusual house he built himself, and his backyard was the Martello Tower.
Right.
And I don't think it was really used for anything in particular. So, but now it's a very well-run museum and really classy.
Yes, I've actually been there. And Joyce actually lived there, is that right?
He did. He lived there briefly with Buck Mulligan,
right,
and an English chap. He didn't stay there long because after the incident where the Englishman had a nightmare and Buck Mulligan took a shotgun and then fired at the fireplace, that was the cue for trying to find a new landlord.
So, that's right.
Yeah, but that neck of the woods, you know, Dorky, where the school scene is, and then Fanny Mount Strown on the way into Dublin. If you get the Dart or Dublin area rapid transit from Sandy Cove into University College Dublin, which I did for 4 years when I was studying there, it was also Joyce's university. And it's like a Joycean odyssey. It's strange. You pass all the places, including Westland Row. And Sweeney's chemist, and it's just a reworking of a part of Bloom's journey on that day, on Stephen's journey to encounter him.
Right. So you grew up kind of immersed in the landscape that would be familiar to people who have read Joyce, but I'm guessing for you, it started out just as home.
Yeah, I had no association with Joyce whatsoever. It was just like where I played and where I worked and where I lived and where I kicked soccer and chased girls and all the rest of it. It wasn't it wasn't like there were no joystick associations until I was 16 and I was in a little drama school. Mm-hmm. And they rented the Peacock Theatre, which is underneath the Abbey. And they put on a Sunday evening show, and it was like a Celtic literature show, I suppose. And they asked me to play Stephen Dedalus.
Oh.
And, and I don't know if you're familiar with Stephen D. It's by Hugh Leonard. Mm-hmm. And it's an adaptation of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Stephen Hero combined.
Okay.
And Stephen Dedalus was obviously the central figure in it because the whole thing's autobiographical. But I got to play Stephen D in that, or Stephen Hero, if you like. And that was my first encounter with Joyce. And I think I was then a little bit too immature to really appreciate the magic of it all. But the language fascinated me, and that was my first encounter.
Right. Okay. So had you been acting before that, or was that also your first experience in the theater?
Well, you know, the truth is that I was sent to drama school when I was 8 years old because I was clinically shy and had difficulty interfacing with the rest of the planet. And also I had a Dublin accent you could cut with a carving knife.
Right.
So my parents decided that between my inability to communicate and when I did communicate, my unintelligibility, because of my sense of my dialect, it was time to do something with young Vincent, you know, so they sent me off to drama school to secure me, as it were. Well, I've been secured for permanent, as it turned out. I'm not sure they intended that to go that far. So, so I got the bug very early.
Okay. And then you eventually had some professional success. How old were you when you started performing at the Abbey Theatre?
Well, I have two answers to that question. When I was 17, I was just finishing high school, secondary school, as we called it over there, with the Christian Brothers, very un-Christian. And I was called up to the principal's office, which was usually the, you know, the bell of doom. But actually, he said that the Abbey Theatre had called, and my brother, who was playing a walk-on in Two Lines, in a play by Louis McNeice, was replacing someone who'd been injured during the curtain call because they'd installed new elevators. And they needed a lookalike, and would I go in and play the two lines? And of course, I got a heart attack. But I did go in and I played the two lines, and I'll tell you what they were. I was a vision mixer in the reworking of the Everyman play. And my first line in Act One was, shall I cut now? And my line in Act Two was, you will tell me when to cut. that was all I had, and it was a nervous wreck. And Vincent Dowling was playing the producer, and he used to step on my foot when it was my turn to the line. So all I had to do was remember the order and sequence of lines, and I was home and dry with the microphone. So that was my first inauspicious appearance at the Abbey. And then I played the Odyssey. I went to University College Dublin, then I went to the Abbey Theatre School for 2 years, the School of Acting. And then I went into, believe it or not, into amateur theatre, the number one company now in Sundance Players. And then I went to Paris and studied mind with my family myself for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I came back, my brother had just started a theatre in the suburbs of Dublin called the Oscar Theatre in Bald Bridge, Dublin 4. And I started working there as an actor. My first role was, I think, Mercutio and Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
And years later, an opportunity appeared in the Abbey. I must have been, let me see, it was 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 34 at the time. And the artistic director, Joe Dowling, who now runs the Guppy Theatre in Minneapolis, called me up and said, I've a role for you in the Abbey, but you're not going to want to play it. And I said, you must be insane. Of course I want to play it. He said, not when you hear what it is. I said, tell me more. He says, it's the title role in a new work. I said, that sounds fine to me. He says, it's not actually in the Abbey, it's downstairs in the Peacock. I said, fine. He said, it's not a play, it's a musical. I said, you have a problem here, Joe, because I can't sing. I think my parents sent me to mind school when they heard me sing. So he said, don't worry about that because you don't have any lines. I said, I don't. He said, no. I said, I thought you said I was playing the title role. He said, you are. He said, it's a musical for children. It's on at lunchtime. It's in the Peacock. and it's only running for a week, and it's called the Lugnaquilla Gorilla. And you're the gorilla. So, Lugnaquilla is the highest mountain range in Ireland. So I played the gorilla, and I just like swung from the bars of the cage and chewed bananas and grunted and scratched my armpits, basically. And that was my second bite at the National Theatre. So, you know, I know, like, earlier when you were talking to my daughter, you said something about did he get success early? In very small integers to begin with, was the answer to that. So, yeah, but I got my foot in the door, or my claw in the door, as it were, and then they asked me to be movement director for a couple of plays, Shakespeare, actually, and then I got involved with Patrick Mason, who was my mentor when I was in the School of Acting, and he went on to greater things. He was a voice coach for the Abbey Company, and then he started directing, and he became a kind of an internationally celebrated director. In fact, he won the Tony Award for Dancing at Lunasa, the Brian Frew play, when he brought it up to Broadway. Yeah, and in his early days, he was working with an experimental Irish playwright called Tom McIntyre, Theatre of the Living Image, if you like, and because it was so physical, and I trained in mine, he asked me to be movement director for it. And then they were short for a role, and they asked me to be the priest, and I came in, and it was basically improvisatory, so I improvised my way into a more substantial role, and then two lines, and then he did four more in that series of new plays with that author and that director, so and they went on a world tour, so I ended up as a member of the Abbey Theatre Company, and I was there for 5 years before I emigrated.
Right. Okay, and then how did you wind up in Buffalo, New York?
Well, it's a long story, so I hope you have some time here, but I'll try and tell the non-Shaggy Dog version of it. We did Waiting for God over a decade in a tiny theater in Dublin called The Project. Mm-hmm. And the man who directed, a very gifted writer and director and actor called Peter Sheridan. He's one of the famous Sheridan brothers. The other one is Jim Sheridan, who's now a significant filmmaker in Hollywood, in America, and The Name of the Father, My Left Foot, all the Daniel Day-Lewis films he did.
Right,
and the brother Peter stayed in Dublin, and Peter directed Waiting for Godot, and he wanted to bring it to the States. So he called Jim, and Jim was running the Irish Arts Center in New York. He said, can you bring it over? And Jim said, yeah, sure, of course, bring it over, no problem. You can all see me in the apartment. And so we said, great. Chris, my brother, applied for the rights, couldn't get them. And applied again to the amateur rights, because we weren't getting paid, still couldn't get them. Some producer had bought them out. So Jim said, why don't you call a friend of mine in Rochester, New York, John Everett. He's a businessman, he loves all things Irish. Chris did, and John said, over you come, I'll take your plane fares, you sleep on the floor, bring your sleeping bags, you don't get paid for doing the show, but I promise you I'll wine you and dine you, and that was the deal.
Right.
And we went there and we played at Nazareth College in Rochester. It was a huge success. Somebody in Buffalo saw us, said, can you bring it to Buffalo? We said, what's the deal? They said, well, they're not getting paid. This is like the land of the free and, you know,
right.
were paved with gold. All the old Irish ballads turned out to be not quite so easy. But anyway, they had a hotel and they had a bar, the Shannon Bar. And so we hung out there. We had a great time. And The show, again, was a huge success. My brother stayed on in America, never came back. I was with the Abbey, so I returned to Ireland. And 5 years later, I got a visa in the mail and offered me a permanent residence. So I said to her, I was newly married, and Laura was one year old,
mm-hmm.
and my daughter, and we said, well, shall we give it a shot? And we said, we'll do it for 6 months. So we moved all my belongings to my mother's attic, and we came for 6 months, and that was 26 years ago.
Wow.
We never went back, and the reason we never went back was because we started the theatre company in our first year, and it really took off, the Irish Classical Theatre.
Right.
And if you're an actor, you can act whenever you want, and you can direct whenever you want, and you can choose the plays you really believe in and are committed to and want to do. Well, that is kind of the actor's dream, and I wasn't going to turn my back on that. So
yeah, but I would guess it's an amazing story. It's a great story, And I was thinking that the advantage was all of the artistic control that you've been able to have. On the other hand, it also probably comes with a lot of challenges of running a business and marketing and having hiring and firing people and keeping the lights on and all of that. Was that something that you had been doing when you were in Ireland, or was that all new to you?
Well, I ran the theater with my brother, and mm-hmm. we also started the theater school, the Oscar School of Acting, and I ran a mime company, and I had run a children's theater school, so I had a lot under my belt before I came over here.
Right.
I had my brother, he was in a soap on Irish television called The Weirdens, which ran for 40 years, and he used to run tours around Ireland to little kind of holiday villages in the summer, and I was a tour manager for those, and he was the entrepreneur and the producer, and he had an agency for actors, and actually Gabriel Byrne and Liam Neeson were two of the stage actors who were in his agency before they appeared before a camera.
Oh, really?
So he always bemoaned the fact that if he stayed with him, he would have been a millionaire. So I think people move on, you know. So
right,
yeah. So we had a background, I suppose, in running things and being entrepreneurs and I suppose a bit of leadership and all that. But I'd say that the two areas, truthfully, that were completely new for me. One was fundraising. I didn't realize that it's in a not-for-profit. You know, 50% comes from box office and the other 50% comes from, you know, philanthropy mm-hmm. or, you know, government funding, state, city, county funding, foundation funding, corporate funding, individuals. And you have to tap into all those different markets and please them and inveigle them into seeing their work and then falling in love with the work and then keeping the relationship going. And that was completely new to me. Mm. The other area was marketing, that it doesn't matter how good a product you have or how classy or high quality the work is, if nobody knows about it, nobody comes to see it. So
right.
Marketing became as important as, you know, the quality of the work. So I suppose marketing and development of fundraising were the two really challenging areas, yeah.
Right. Well, something has gone right. I saw on the website that it's your 25th anniversary season of the Irish Classical Theatre Company. Are you planning to celebrate that in any way?
Well, we already have. We're coming out of it. In fact, we start rehearsals tomorrow for Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth, which is the beginning of our 26th season. So, yeah, but the beginning of the year, we had this phenomenon here in Buffalo called Curtain Up. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's unique in the world of theater, where all of 20 theater companies open their doors at the same moment. All the curtains go up at exactly the same moment, 8:00 p.m. on Friday, the 20th of September, whatever. And all the artists like to give a little speech, and then we do the show together. Before that, there's a dinner that the community are invited to, and then they drift down to the theaters, and after the show, there's a huge street party with jugglers and all the rest of it, and bands and whatever. So it's quite the night, and it's the official opening of the theater season. So on that night, we had our own individual party to celebrate the 25th, and then at the end of the season, we did An Ideal Husband by Oscar Wilde, and we brought the entire cast back and some of our major donors and all our staff and people who helped us out through the 25 years. And unfortunately, a couple of widows of people who were involved in the early part of the organizing the whole thing. And we had a wonderful party. So we kind of bookended it with a celebration at the beginning and the end.
Wow. Well, congratulations and good luck for the next 25 years.
Well, thank you.
Okay, so let's get back
I'll check in with you in 25 years' time. Let you know how I'm doing.
Well, I hope you'll come back on the show before then. Let's talk about your interest in James Joyce. Now, so there you were. Sure. After you appeared in the play, was that when you started reading his works and realizing that you had a famous author who basically had written about all of the places that you knew so well?
Really, no. And I should answer yes to that question, but the truth is no, I didn't make the connection. I kept hearing the name James Joyce, but I wasn't I wasn't familiar with his work, but I did go to University College Dublin, and I'm glad that I went to the old UCD, which is the Newman House in, you know, St. Stephen's Green, where Joyce went.
Right.
And my first year of English class, I had a professor called Augustine Martin, who was a Joycean, and he introduced me to Portrait of the Artist, and I was smitten. I was kind of the instant love, if you like. And then I went back, of course, and remembered Stephen D, and I reread Hugh Leonard Stephen D, and then I went back and read Stephen Hero, and then Dubliners, and then I really got into it. But it took a while before I kind of took on Ulysses. But
right.
I did have one other Joycean encounter, which was there was a summer where I didn't have any theater lined up. There was a new theater company called Stage One, running out of Trinity College in Dublin, where I actually went for my graduate studies. But they had a little theater in Number 3 Trinity College, as you go in the archway on the right-hand side there, and the quad. And it was run by Douglas Kennedy, who's now a very famous novelist, and a chap called Robert McNamara, who runs a theater company in Washington, D.C. And back in the day, they were kind of graduate students at Trinity in English, and they decided to run this company for the summer. They went to the States. And I saw they were doing Crap's Last Tape, which is one of my favorite plays. So I went in for this. Now, I'm in my late 20s, you know, and Crap is at the end of his life. So when I walked in, they said, well, what are you auditioning for? And I said, Crap. They started laughing. They said, we're not going to let you audition for Crap. I said, but that's what I want to audition for. They said, well, we're not going to let you because we're not going to cast you. I said, look, if you're good enough an actor, you can play anything. They said, we're not going to cast you. They said, I said, can I read anyway? They said, you can read anyway, but we're not going to cast you. I said, fine. And I read. And, of course, they didn't cast me. But they were doing two other plays that summer. One was The Jesuit by Donald Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was Exiles. Which, of course, is James Joyce's only play.
Right.
And so I went through the archway a week later to check the results, knowing I didn't get cast, and I wasn't. But I was sticking out of curiosity through the other casts, and I saw I was cast as Richard Rowan in Exiles. And you're familiar with the play. Richard Rowan, of course, is the Joyce character and the protagonist in Exiles.
Mm-hmm.
I went home and read the play, and I wasn't hugely impressed, but it was a great opportunity. So we did it in Trinity during an international Joyce convention. So there were all kinds of, like, Joycean experts came to see it, and they loved it. And Marie Jola, who was a special friend of Joyce, she came and saw it. I met her afterwards, and she said, you are like him, Joyce. You sound like him, and you look like him, but there is a problem. James Joyce always crossed his legs 3 times, and you only crossed him twice. So I made that little change to my performance for the rest of the run.
I think you would have to, yeah.
So, and we packed the place, and then we went, it was only 100 seats, and then we brought an entourage down to the Everyman in Cork, in the South, and nobody came to see us.
Wow.
We had like 12 people in the audience, you know, so it was 6 after the intermission, you know. So, yeah, I don't think it's a great play, quite honestly, and I hate to say this, and I'm talking about a genius here, but truthfully, I think that when he wrote Exiles, he was going through his Ibsen phase, and was so influenced by Ibsen, that instead of writing first-class theatrical joy, he wrote second-class Ibsen. And I think that's why it failed.
Okay, I'm going to pause there for a moment. Our audio faded a bit, so I had to make some edits. We talked about the magical language and rhythm and musicality of Joyce's prose, the glamorous squalor of Joyce's Dublin, the theatricality of the novel Ulysses, and a one-man show that Vincent staged in which he played James Joyce. We'll resume again where he's discussing his efforts to adapt Finnegan's Wake for the stage. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen.
All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup. And you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
I could see a couple of approaches to take. One might be, I think one of Joyce's his aims was not to have a single coherent chronological narrative, but to have more of a multiplicity of plots and storylines and themes that overlap and wind around each other. And one Yes. approach I think you might take would be to kind of sort some of that out and present something that would maybe be a single interpretation of the things in Finnegan's Wake. And another approach might be to explore what it would mean to have, you know, the storylines kind of exploded all over the place. And I'm wondering which one, how you approached bringing that to the stage.
Well, I took the first of those two possibilities. Mm-hmm. And the more I read it, the more I realized that there were five central characters. Now, when I say there's five central characters, they multiply. They multiply in, right. into, so, you know, H.C.E., the father, mm-hmm. Humphrey Chimpton Earwaker, he's a father figure, but he's also Fionn McCool, and he's also Cúchulainn, and he's also Brian Boru, and he's also like all of Irish history.
Right.
And he's the Dublin Mountains, so he's got geographical and historical and cultural and all kinds of, you know, if you like, splinters or multiplications or manifestations. And then Anna Olivia is the wife, and she's also very obviously the River Liffey, but she's also the Earth Mother, and she's all mothers. Mm-hmm. And then you have the twins and the sons, Sean and Shem. Shem, is, of course, is a corruption of James, so it's James Joyce. So Shem and Sean are the two twins, but they're both Joyce. They're the yin and yang of Joyce. Mm-hmm. You think of like Brian Friel's Philadelphia, Here I Come, where you've got Gar Public and Gar Private. It's a little bit like the same concept where you've got Shem and Sean is the extrovert and Shem is the introvert and artist. So it's the two sides that any of us have, but it's really one person. So he's the son, and then Isabella is the daughter, and Isabella is also the little stream that becomes the mother, and Isabella is all females before maturity, and I suppose the quintessential virgin, and the incestuous sister, and all young girls, and he calls her Puccella and Nuvoletta. Nuvoletta means little cloud, so that's her kind of geographical manifestation. So each of them has like 100 identities. But if you burrow down underneath all the different identities, you keep coming back to the number five, which is the mother, the father, the twin brothers, and the daughter. So I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to travel through the novel and just latch onto these five characters mm-hmm. and see what their particular journey is. And even that was inordinately difficult because like Don Quixote, Cervantes, it just keeps going in circles. And there's so many digressions that you forget what the main focus was before you went on the multiplicity of digressions.
Right.
So it was quite the job, but I got there.
And characters will change and without being announced that the characters have changed or
there's
no sort of guideposts or markers to help the reader along the way. It's simulating more of a dreamlike experience.
Yeah, and dream is the perfect, word for it. It's dream nightmare, if you like. Mm-hmm. I called my adaptation Night Maze, M-A-Z-E,
mm-hmm.
because it's a nightmare, but it's also it's the night, it's the obscurity, the darkness, the other side that we don't like to show of ourselves, because again, it's an act of courage. And then maze, of course, because it's a labyrinth, because he deliberately creates, pools within pools within pools, so it's like a vortex.
Right.
And but I called it Night Maze, and I had huge problems getting the rights from Stephen Joyce, who's Joyce's grandson, who's a notoriously difficult individual.
Yeah.
Notoriously difficult. But he no longer holds the rights because Joyce is public domain now. So one of the happiest days of my life was when Joyce became public domain. Not because I wanted to do a lot more adaptations of Joyce, but because that individual could no longer control his grandfather's work, because his grandfather's work is so rich that it belongs to the world, it doesn't belong to an individual, So after 14 rewrites, he allowed me to produce it, but only if I didn't get any royalties from it, and all the royalties went directly to him.
Right.
And so, I was so anxious to put it on at that point, I didn't care, and I never did it to make money anyway, so...
Right.
I directed it, and I got five wonderful actors, and we put it on. I think it was the most surprising production we've ever put on. We have a very loyal audience that we built up over, I think it was 18 years then. And they came.
Right.
And they built a place for 5 weeks.
Wow.
Now, they had mixed feelings about it. Some people said it's the best thing I've ever seen, and I'll never miss another show you do. And the other half said, if you ever do a show like that again, I'm never coming back. So it really split people, but I'm really pleased I did it. And it was one of the kind of milestones, I think, in the history of the company.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the whole project, the whole undertaking of it. So when you were going through Finnegan's Wake in such a deep way, I know that basically no two critics or no two scholars agree on exactly, like, they could never write a plot summary that everyone else would agree with. And I'm wondering,
absolutely, yeah.
Did you feel like Joyce was in some ways inviting you to be creative and to use your own imagination and your own intellect in order to, fully absorb and process what you were reading? Or did you feel like he was kind of, five steps ahead of you and you were chasing him and you could never quite catch up to whatever it was that he had in mind.
He's a thousand steps ahead of all of us.
Yeah.
And deliberately so. I mean, he said he wanted to write a work that would keep the professors guessing for centuries. And in that he was very successful. I think he's created more PhD students in English literature than anybody else in the history of literature, because it's so open to interpretation. So it's, the truth is that anybody who takes it on, it's going to be your personal interpretation of it. But I feel like I've had so many encounters with Joyce's work, and not in an academic way, but in a visceral, personal way in terms of bringing his work to life on stage.
Right.
And kind of filtering through my persona, and especially my experience growing up in Dublin. And like Joyce, I was kind of lower middle class, and like Joyce, I was a Catholic, and like Joyce, I went to the Christian Brothers, and not the Jesuits, but the Christian Brothers in his early days. And like Joyce, I went to University College Dublin, and he became an artist, and in a very different way, I suppose, being an actor, I became an interpreter of artists. So it's like the journeys are, he's a genius, and I certainly am, but the journeys, the life journeys, are very, very parallel. So Right. And especially your knowledge of Dublin and Dubliners and the Dublin vernacular and how people express themselves and their sense of humor and their inability to take themselves seriously. And then, you know, for the last 20 years before I did it, I'd been, you know, putting on productions. We put on 180 productions, over 25 years. So we do 6 a year, and usually like half of those are Irish. So I've dabbled in every Irish writer, particularly every Irish dramatist, one point or another in my. So I think all of that kind of filters into when you're reading the novel, which is voluminous, you come across phrases. You see, that's a spoken word. That's not a metaphor. That is something somebody said. And then you got to backtrack and say, would this come out of the mouth of Isabella? Would this come out of the mouth of Anne Olivia? And if so, in what context does it fit? And it's trying to pull those strands together into some kind of coherent narrative without at the same time cheating the circular kind of structure of the book. And that really was the challenge. But I came well armed, I suppose, to it. And with a huge degree of innocence, because I think if you get too academically involved, you lose your ability to just step outside of it completely and just in a almost disingenuous way, just pick the plums that, make the orchard.
Right, right. Yeah, he's very earthy and grounded, even as he's always, can also be very aesthetic and intellectual. You obviously have a great deal of respect and admiration for Joyce, and I think it's clear that he was an inspiration. I'm wondering, were there times when you were going through all of those drafts where you resented Joyce, or you felt like he had been more obscure than he needed to be, or were there any feelings that you had had enough of Joyce and you'd be happy if you never picked up another book of his?
No, truthfully, and I'm not saying what I think you want to hear. There's so much. It's like Shakespeare, everything Shakespeare wrote was pure untrammeled genius, but there's so much magic there.
Right.
And Joyce was obsessed with Shakespeare, and rightly so, because Shakespeare was the greatest, dramatist that ever lived, and I believe Joyce was the greatest novelist that ever lived. And it's totally understandable that he would have been obsessed with them. And just like Shakespeare, there's so many riches there.
Right.
That if you have to take a circuitous journey to find the gold underneath the earth, it's worth it. It's worth going subterranean just to find the magic and the diamonds and the minerals that are down there. And and they're there, even in the opening page of Finnegan's Wake, you find them, or Ulysses or any of the books. The one work I didn't mention to you is Dubliners, and we can go back to Finnegan's Wake, but The Dead was adapted for the stage. I believe it was by Terence McNally. Mm-hmm. I know the music was by Sean Davey, a great Irish contemporary musician, and it lends itself to a dramatization. I think a lot of Joyce does, except for Exiles.
Right.
And we did this several Christmases ago, a large cast, and it's not really a musical. It's a play in which there are songs, around the piano, the basic premise.
Right.
And it was so successful that we revived it, and we did it 2 years in a row, and we're going to revive it again. It's a really nice adaptation. So coming back to your earlier question of does Joyce have an intrinsic theatricality, to me, without a shadow of doubt, he does.
Yeah.
I suppose where my instincts and my sensitivities and my proclivities would have been kind of drawn to the man, because I can smell the theatricality of it. And yet underneath the theatricality, as with all good theater, there's a humanity simmering underneath the surface.
It's interesting, as I was thinking about Joyce and getting ready for this podcast, I was thinking, a lot of his contemporary authors, I'm thinking of, some of the famous Americans who were also writing in the 20s and 30s, like Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald. And, You know, they all had kind of a relationship with Hollywood, and they would, some of them would work on screenplays, or they would, you know, meet the directors and work with them. As far as I know, Joyce never really had that relationship, and it seems like theater was just a more natural home for him and a more natural fit. It's hard to imagine him like living in Hollywood and working on screenplays to make money, for example. He seems to be...
No, but he did love cinema.
Oh,
and,
he did?
And here's a fact that not a lot of people know, is that the first cinema in Ireland was founded by James Joyce.
Oh.
It was called the Volta, and mm-hmm. I think Pierce Street, you know, off the Trinity College there in the center of Dublin, and it was a failed enterprise, but he thought that, you know, because his experience in Zurich and Paris and all the rest of it on the continent, and he'd seen cinema, and he thought this was something that doesn't exist in Ireland and should, and he thought it'd be a great way to come back to Ireland covered in glory, opening
right.
the first, but it didn't really take off. So he was interested in cinema, and his work is cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he was interested in writing screenplays or, you know, I'm sure the whole Hollywood thing would not have held any huge attraction for him. Who knows, though, if he were writing now, it probably would.
Yeah, know? Right. He definitely had, you know, his facility with story and with moments. I mean, in The Dubliners,
right.
his emphasis on epiphanies and, you know, it could really translate well.
But a lot of the other connection with the other writers you mentioned is that they, all of them virtually spent time in Paris.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the Impressionist painters, you know, there are periods in history, whether it's painting or literature, where there's a great coming together of minds,
mm-hmm.
Like Beckett and Joyce working together in Paris, but with Ezra Pound and all the others. And,
right.
And then Ezra Pound in influencing Yeats and introducing him to the whole kind of no theater canon, and all that kind of fertility and interaction it happens in waves. And I think there was a wave in Paris when Joyce was there, and not just that Beckett worked as a secretary, but with Ezra Pound and the others, there's just a blooming, if you forgive, of talent. And I think Paris was the catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you grew up in Dublin, even in my day, it was very repressive and very claustrophobic, and the Catholic Church had an overarching control over everything, including education, and they're even written into the Constitution that they have rights that other religions don't, and which from an American viewpoint would be anti-constitutional.
Right.
But that's the kind of influence they had. If you think of Franco in Spain, it was very, very similar with De Valera in Ireland. And growing up in that, you know, he said, non serviam, I will not serve. And, you know, he's going to go off to Europe and use silence, exile, and cunning as a survival tool, because he felt that the Catholic Church and then the English colonialism and the pettiness of the Irish, that trifecta was destroying his artistic kind of, you know, creative personal crucible, so he felt he had to exile himself.
Right.
And I don't think it's accidental that Shaw was in exile, Oscar Wilde was in exile, Yeats for a long period was in exile, Beckett was, Joyce was. And this is not just an accident of history. This was because genuinely creative people, especially in literature at that time, were not allowed to express themselves fully. Think of Things Table of the Western World and what happened on the opening night in the Abbey, or
mm-hmm.
I think of Donald Casey's Plough on the Stars. Anything that pushed against the status quo had this immediate kind of populist backlash, which
right.
was, you know, carefully fomented by the powers that be, and, you know, the military and the ruling English and the Catholic Church. So, I mean, somebody with his courage and creative powers, he had to escape. And this is not some kind of anti-Irish diatribe. I adore Ireland and my roots are there and everything I've ever made because I'm Irish and I love the country to death. So I'm just talking about a certain period in history that people felt, he kept talking about the nets that were holding him down, you know,
mm-hmm.
and escaping the nets. And he did. And I think that's what happened in Paris. Paris was You know, again, it was the crucible of creativity and openness and flexibility, and people were incentivized to, you know, create new worlds for themselves and to take risks and to be outrageous and, you know, whether to lose the Trek or whoever you're talking about, there was an outrageousness there that was not only permitted but almost encouraged. And
right.
I think and Joyce certainly kind of rode on that wave to a certain extent.
Right. One of the things that interests me about Joyce and his artistic exile, I guess is maybe the best way to put it, is, you know, what he didn't do was leave and then sort of say, well, I've you know, shaken that from my past. I'm brushing that away. But he so obviously loved Dublin, and I think his quote was he wanted to rebuild it brick by brick. And
That's correct, the
idea of leaving it just seems all the more aching and poignant because it's so obvious where he had so much love for his home.
His heart is totally, I mean, it's a living scandal that he's not buried in Dublin, because if he came back to Earth and he was granted one wish, would be, you know, instead of being in Blautern Cemetery, wherever it is in Zurich,
right,
that he would be, you know, back in Dublin.
Right.
Just as Yeats's body was repatriated, and I'm sure he would, because his heart, as you rightly say, his heart, his soul, his being, his memories, his whole living presence belongs to Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Everything he ever wrote about, directly or indirectly, was about Dublin. And I think, you know, and I had a slightly similar experience myself. By leaving Dublin, you grow an appreciation of it. You love it more. You see it in comparison, and going back there, you can embrace it more fully. And I think that's what happened to him. And I think he had to leave it in order to recreate it. And, you know, in 500 years' time, people will still see Dublin, the city, no matter what happens to it, it's now a very cosmopolitan city, through the prism of Joyce's work. Because
right.
he, in an ultimate way, totally captured the essence of that city like no one ever has.
Right. I was going to ask you about that, but I think maybe you've already answered the question of whether you reading Joyce after having spent so many years yourself outside of Dublin, if that resonated for you in particular, that Joyce had gone through a similar kind of passage.
Of course. Of course. I don't even like putting myself in the same kind of sentence.
Right, right.
But, you know, we're all human. We all have similar experiences. And reading Joyce as an exile is a profound experience and a very personal experience and a hugely nostalgic experience. You know, it's interesting. Like, recently I saw that film, the Caribbean film, Brooklyn, about emigration and about Saoirse Ronan role was split between her love for the new country and her heart being in the old country. And that fissure, if you like, that when I wept when I saw the film, because I realized that you think you've left, but you haven't left, because you can't leave.
Mm-hmm.
You're geographically displaced, but you can't leave Ireland. So when you read Joyce's work, which are really a poem of love to his native country, no matter how much he ponders it, it's love. You can read it in the pages. And, of course, it's very, very moving for anybody in my situation.
Right. Now, there's one other performative aspect of Ulysses I wanted to ask you about, and that is Bloomsday celebrations.
Right.
And for listeners who might not be familiar with this, it's essentially... the novel Ulysses takes place in a single day, June 16th, and Bloomsday celebrations will often have public readings of the entire novel different people will, in Dublin, I guess people will go to visit different places and settings that occur in the novel. And I understand that you've been involved with some Bloomsday celebrations of your own. Were you, and I know you've done them in Buffalo, did you also participate in any when you were in Ireland?
No, you know, the second last time I've been to Ireland twice this summer, and I was there last summer, and I was asked to buy a bar of soap in the Sheen's pharmacy that the Paul Bloom goes into. So I went down to the pharmacy, and sure enough, of course, they're selling the soap, and When I was there, there were 7 people reading Ulysses. So it was like Guinness World Book of Records. There was nothing to do with Bloom's Day. It was like in July, but they were reading, you know, and it goes on all day, every day. And so it's like there's a permanent pilgrimage to Joyce, if you like, going on in Dublin.
Wow.
Certainly in Sheen's Pharmacy. And I attended a lot of Bloom's Day events. And I certainly did excerpts from Joyicity, which is full of Ulysses, in different places in Bloomsday. When I was there, I was invited by the Irish ambassador to Japan to bring Joyicity to Tokyo the week of Bloomsday, and I did it in his embassy, and then I did it for the James Joyce Society of Japan, and then we traveled on to Sydney, and I did it at the Crossroads Theatre in Sydney for 2 weeks.
Wow.
And that was a 2-week celebration of Bloomsday. So, and we have our own celebration here, and I also brought it to Toronto, because where they celebrate Bloomsday in a huge way. But in Buffalo, we started our own Bloomsday. There's a friend of mine called Lauren Shine, who's a lover of all things Irish, and, you know, a great, you know, admirer and of Irish literature, and he's a kind of Renaissance encyclopedic knowledge of everything Irish. And he was a barman in one of the Irish bars here, and I was chatting with him on Sunday afternoon, and we were talking about Bloomsday. I said, where do they celebrate it here? He said, ironically, they don't. I said, why don't they? He said, I don't know. I said, you love Joyce. I love Joyce. Let's do it. So we went to a friend of ours, Jim Ward, and we took over his house in the backyard, and we invited 60 people. And this was 18 years ago when we started Bloomsday Buffalo. There's actually a website, Bloomsday Buffalo. And we've been doing it for 18 years. And we started in the backyard. Then we brought it to our theater. And then we expanded and we do it all over the city, including, you know, in the graveyard for the grave scene. And, you know, down by the sea for the, you know, Nausicaa scene and all the rest of it. So it's become quite the annual celebration in Buffalo, and our theatre company, Irish Classical Theatre, is very, very closely associated with it, and all the actors that work with us throughout the year, they do the reading, so it's quite theatrical, and, you know, it's a wonderful event.
Oh, that's great. You know, I wonder if what originally, or what continues to animate Bloomsday celebrations, is the feeling people get when they're reading Ulysses, is that it really is almost meant to be read aloud.
Well, I think, as with all Joyce, it's meant to be read aloud.
Right.
Because, as I said earlier, his you know, quintessentially musical ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say Dylan Thomas, you know, when he was composing his poetry, that in the shed at the back of his garden, he would be like chanting it until the rhythms were right. And when, you know, Yeats was staying in Coole Park, he'd keep Lizzie Gregory awake at night, you know, chanting the rhythms of his poems before he found the lyrics, before he found the words to the poem. So, again, it's something in the Celtic character, where the musicality comes first, and then I think the language, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true even now, if you look at, you know, Martin McDonagh or Sebastian Barry, or, you know, even contemporary writers, it's all about the rhythm and the language and the musicality. And so for Joyce, I think the musicality came first.
Right. Well, that's thank you so much for talking to me today. I really have enjoyed this, and I just love the idea of all of your efforts to marry your interest in James Joyce and your experience and your expertise in the theater. And I did,
sure.
Take a look at the upcoming season of the Irish Classical Theater Company, and I have to say, it makes me wish that I lived closer to Buffalo so I could attend more of these. I'm going to post a link to the website in the show notes, but it looks like you have quite
Please
a season. You have a good season coming up with Amadeus and the Noel Coward play. You mentioned Hay Fever, or Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth. And what are you excited about this year?
Well, you know, I love Tennessee Williams. Sweet Bird of Youth is a great way get the season off the ground. Peter Schaefer died this year, so we're doing a tribute to him with Equus, which is arguably his greatest play, and Amadeus. And we're doing Amadeus with the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra.
Oh, wow.
playing live, which would be wonderful. We did Boys Like Gentlemen with them a couple of years ago, and it just adds a whole other, you can imagine the entire, you know, 70-piece orchestra behind us.
Wow.
As we perform, it's just a, it's a wonderful experience. Then we're doing a new play by a wonderful Irish playwright called Brian Delaney, called The Seedbed, and that's kind of a Western Europe premiere. And then Terence Radigan's The Winslow Boy, and then we're going to finish up, as you said, with Noel Coward's Hay Fever.
Oh, wow.
So it's, yeah, quite the journey, yeah. So I did just want to mention to you that, that my daughter Laura's younger brother, Jamie, was named after James Joyce. So I'm hoping somehow he carried the baton.
How old is Jamie?
Jamie's 24.
24. Yeah. Okay. So has he taken after you, and does he enjoy reading the works of Joyce, or is that something?
He loves language. Well, they grew up, we know babysitters, so, and my wife is an actress, so they grew up sitting in theaters watching us rehearse. So I think they've got an unwanted immersion in language. But yeah, he's taken to the stage, and he's an engineer by profession. He just graduated, but he did 3 shows last year, finishing up about Mice and Men. So who knows?
Right.
You know, who knows? Estes is alive and well in Buffalo.
You know, I have a funny story for you. I was once an English teacher in Taiwan. And I had kids would come in, and their teachers would give them English names, you know, so that they could, while they were in English class, we could call them by their English name. And for the kindergarten classes, they didn't have their names yet. And so the teacher would ask them to, would ask me to give them names. And there was a set of twins that came in, a boy and a girl, and I gave them the names James and Joyce. So if you ever, I think they're probably, you know, in their 20s by now. So if you ever encounter a Taiwanese family and they have children named James and Joyce, you can probably thank me for that.
That's delightful. Delightful. Yeah. So we all pass on the baton in our different ways.
That's right. Right. That's right. That's my contribution to letters.
Good for you.
Okay, well, best of luck for a successful season, and thanks again for joining me today on The History of Literature.
No, it's a pleasure and an honor, and good luck with the podcast, and I love the interview, every second of it.
Okay, there we go. Wasn't that great? Oh, I enjoyed that immensely. Every second of it, as Vincent said. Maybe even more. Is that possible? More than every second? Vincent said something I've been revolving around in my mind ever since. If James Joyce returned to Earth and could be granted one wish, it would be that he be buried in Ireland. I can't stop thinking about that. That's the wish he would have. Not to be alive, but to change where he's buried. Is that how death works? I think that must mean there's a heaven. Because otherwise, I think if I had one wish, it would probably be that I don't want to be buried at all, anywhere. But maybe he's right. I hope he is. It's a nice thought. Speaking of nice thoughts, you can get more episodes of the History of Literature podcast by subscribing to the show through iTunes and Stitcher and all kinds of other podcast apps. While you're there, please show us some love with ratings and reviews, or you can leave a comment on the website or on Facebook. Share us, like us, or send us an email at jackwilsonauthor@gmail.com. Leave a comment at jackwilson.com. All kinds of ways to get in touch with us. Maybe you think we've missed something, or you have a request. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. That's going to do it for this episode. My thanks again to the extraordinary Vincent O'Neill of the Irish Classical Theatre Company, and to his wonderful daughter, Laura, for putting us in touch. And of course, to you, dear listeners, for joining us on this journey. My thanks to all of you. Each and every one of you. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.